We're now here for this week in Palestine, and I'll let Despina announce the program.
Thank you, and welcome to the October 31st edition of This Week in Palestine. Today we'll be speaking with three individuals who have worked directly with Palestinian refugees. But first, the update from the International Middle East Media Center.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imenc.org, from October 23rd to 29th, 2010. Egypt attempts to push the Palestinians to resume talks with Israel. Meanwhile, Israeli military and settlers continue assaults against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. These are stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let us begin our weekly report as usual with the non-violent activities in West Bank. IMEMC's Doris Norito has the details.
This week, anti-war protests took place in the villages of Belain and Nilain in the central West Bank, and also in Al-Masara in the southern West Bank. Israeli and international supporters joined the villagers at all three locations. This week, the protesters commemorated the 54th anniversary of the Israeli massacre in Kfar Qassam. On the evening of October 29th, 1956, Israeli troops shot and killed 49 unarmed Palestinian civilians in the village of Kfar Qassam, which is 20 kilometers east of Tel Aviv near the Green Line. One Palestinian was injured and dozens were treated for tear gas inhalation after a confrontation with Israeli troops during the weekly march to protest the wall in the village of Belain. The protesters shouted slogans opposing the separation wall and to Israel's settlement and detainment policies. When protesters reached the wall and tried to cross into the Palestinian land on the other side, the Israeli military shot rubber bullets, sound bombs, and tear gas canisters at them. Samar Bernat, 34, was injured when a tear gas canister exploded on his shoulder. Also on Friday, in the nearby village of Nilain, Israeli troops used tear gas and sound bombs to stop protesters. International and Israeli supporters joined the villagers at midday for prayers at land sites near the Israeli separation wall, which was built on villagers' lands. Later, people marched up to the gate of the wall, which separates farmers from their land. Troops stationed beside the barrier fired tear gas and sound bombs at the unarmed protesters. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. The weekly protest ended with clashes between local youth and Israeli soldiers who chased them back to the village. The clashes ended shortly thereafter. No injuries were reported. Elsewhere, Israeli troops stopped the weekly protest march protesting the wall and settlements in the Palestinian village of Al-Masara. Israeli troops broke up the protest with tear gas and sound bombs. One unarmed Israeli activist was beaten by police and taken away. For IMEMC.org, this is Doris Norito.
Israeli troops and intelligence services carried out a number of invasions into Palestinian civilian areas, abducted dozens of Palestinians. Troops also killed one and wounded another in Gaza Strip. IMEMC's Alessandra Bajek has more.
This week, the Israeli army kidnapped Palestinian citizens from Beit Omar and towns near Hebron. Several kidnappings were also reported in Qalqilya. Soldiers invaded areas of Jenin and Bethlehem, breaking into many homes and conducting a number of interrogations. In several towns across the West Bank, homes were ransacked in a claimed search for weapons. Meanwhile, 19 Palestinians were reportedly abducted in East Jerusalem, including 7 children aged 11 to 15. Tension between the local Palestinian residents of Jerusalem and Israeli settlers have been high during the past few months after groups of Israeli settlers forcibly took over some houses in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Silwan. Also in the West Bank, a Palestinian boy was killed by a police car near the West Bank city of Hebron. Local sources reported that the young man, who was identified as Mahmoud Al-Amour, 17 years old, from Yatta village, was hit by the police car as he was attempting to cross the road. On Wednesday, five Palestinians were detained from the villages of Madama and Beta near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Eyewitnesses reported that a large Israeli military force invaded the two villages, broke into a number of houses and kidnapped the five in the early hours of the morning. In the northern West Bank city of Jenin, Israeli soldiers and the Israeli intelligence chief broke many houses claimed to be belonging to Hamas leaders in the city. No abductions were made, however, local sources said troops ransacked some of the invading houses. Children from Om Al-Khair invited the premiere of a film featuring them at the Children's Film Festival in Tel Aviv were refused entry into Israel. The children, first and second graders, were supposed to enter by the Meitar checkpoint in order to watch the screening of the film Galacticus, in which they appear as part of the Children Make Movies project, run jointly by the Education Ministry, the Children's Channel, and the Lahav and Mifalot associations. Galacticus, which was filmed last year, features children from Om Al-Khair and Israeli children from Kibbutz Aher. Palestinians are not allowed to enter Jerusalem and Israeli areas unless they obtain a special permit from Israeli military, which is rarely granted. This week, Israeli Navy gunboats opened fire at several Palestinian fishing boats in the south of Gaza. No injuries were reported. On Monday, Israeli soldiers invaded the southern part of the Gaza Strip. During the invasion, Al-Quds brigades exchanged fire with the Israeli army. However, no injuries were reported. Two Palestinians were killed on Monday due to an attack at one of the southern Gaza's tunnels. Although some Palestinians have been trafficking weapons in the Gaza Strip through the tunnels, yet many others use them to traffic much-needed supplies, especially after the tight siege imposed by Israel on the Gaza Strip since June of 2006. On Wednesday, a Palestinian man was killed in northern Gaza by shrapnel fragments fired by Israeli tanks stationed outside of the Gaza borders. A worker was also injured in the same area by Israeli troops while he was collecting scrap metal from destroyed buildings to sell them for income. In addition, Israeli warplanes flew over the Gaza Strip at low altitudes and carried out an intensive mock air attack, creating a very loud boom. This move has increased after Israel removed its settlers from the coastal region during the unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in September 2005. From IMC, this is Alessandra Berger.
Egyptian officials in the region to push up stalled Palestinian-Israeli peace process. Meanwhile, Arab media sources reported that American and Palestinian officials are holding secret meetings to find a way out of current impasse. On the internal politics, rival Palestinian parties Fatah and Hamas are expected to resume national unity talks. YMEMC's Rami Al-Magari has the story.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says Palestinians have a number of options to consider if Israel doesn't halt settlement construction in the Palestinian territories. He did not detail the alternatives, but did indicate restarting the peace talks is the desired outcome. Egyptian Foreign Minister Ahmed Abolghait told reporters during a joint press conference with Abbas his country has been working with the US and EU to bring the parties back to the negotiating table.
We are currently focused on arguing Israel to accept the internationally backed American-European demand for Israel to stop settlement activities. We should wait and see before we move to other options like going to the UN Security Council or the UN General Assembly or other workable political options.
In September, Arab leaders gave Washington a period of 1 month to convince Israel to halt settlement construction. But just last week, the Israeli pacifist group Peace Now said 600 new homes have been started since Israel lifted the freeze, a construction rate 4 times higher than before the freeze began. In the meantime, Israeli online newspaper Haaretz reported Friday that Israel is considering leasing Palestinian lands from the Palestinian Authority in case an agreement between the two sides is reached. The lease, according to Haaretz, will last from 40 to 99 years, no Palestinian sources commented. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was quoted by Haaretz as saying that the issue of settlement construction won't affect a future peace agreement. Netanyahu was reacting to media reports that Palestinians are currently considering winning international and UN recognition of a Palestinian state on the borders of 1967, which includes the Gaza Strip, West Bank and East Jerusalem. Such a move should be coordinated with us and only through direct talks, the Israeli premier pointed out. In related news, a high-ranking European Union official in Brussels told reporters this week that the EU is relentlessly involved in political efforts to bring Palestinians and Israelis back to the negotiating table. The official voiced rejection of Israeli settlement activities. He also called for a unified Palestinian political stance. Reference was to the disunity between Gaza, which is represented by the ruling Islamist Hamas party, and the West Bank, which is represented by the Fatah-dominated Palestinian Authority. At the internal level, representatives of the rival Fatah and Hamas parties are expected to meet up soon again in Damascus to sort out a number of outstanding unity issues, particularly the security profile. A spokesperson for Hamas in Gaza, Ayman Taha, said Thursday that his party and Fatah seem to be willing to reach an understanding that would serve the Palestinian national interests. According to an Egyptian-produced conciliation paper drafted in October 2009, armed Palestinian resistance factions should be integrated into Palestinian authorities' security bodies, something that Hamas has yet refused. Both parties have been at loggerheads since 2007, when Hamas took over the coastal territory amidst factional fighting. Since then, Israel and the international community have boycotted Hamas until the latter recognizes Israel, accepts past signed agreements with Israel, and renounces violence. Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMCedar.org, Gaza.
And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hussein Cassis and Anna Irazabal.
Thank you and welcome back to This Week in Palestine. And as I noted earlier, our show today is on Palestinian refugees. And before I bring in our first guest, Shireen, who is a high school senior and a volunteer in Aida refugee camp in the West Bank. She volunteered there in the summer of 2009 and with refugees in Lebanon just this past summer. I'd like to do a brief history of the Palestinian refugee issue. According to Badil, Palestinian refugees and internally displaced Palestinians represent the largest and longstanding case of forced displacement in the world today. On the 60th anniversary of the Nakba, the destruction of Palestine and the massive displacement of Palestinians by Israel in 1948 constitutes 2 out of every 5 refugees in the world today are Palestinians. Just think about that. At the beginning of 2007, there were approximately 7 million Palestinian refugees and 450,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, representing 70% of the entire Palestinian population, which at that time was 9.8 million estimated. Palestinian refugees include those who became refugees following the first Arab-Israeli war in 1948 and the second Arab-Israeli war in 1967, as well as those who are neither 1948 or 1967 refugees, but outside the area of former Palestine and unable or unwilling to return owing to a well-founded fear of persecution. The largest group of Palestinian refugees is made up of those who were displaced or expelled from their places of origin as a result of the Nakba. IDPs, or internally displaced persons, include Palestinians who were displaced within Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. It's important to note that internal displacement continues unabated in the occupied territories today. Thousands have been forcibly displaced in the Jordan Valley as a result of closure, home demolition, and eviction orders. And the threat of displacement hangs over those who remain. Similar patterns of forced displacement are found in Israel, where urban development plans for the exclusive benefit of Jewish communities are displacing indigenous Palestinian communities in the Nakab, the Negev, and Galilee. It's also important to note that the Israeli state denies the Nakba and thereby denies the refugees' right of return. In fact, Israel commemorates its Independence Day with a series of events celebrating a Jewish homecoming to the land and the birth of the Jewish state. It's also important to note that early Zionist leader Israel Zangwill spoke of a people without land returning to a land without people. This denial of the Nakba is also found in schools, on official maps, and in the law. It in turn helps perpetuate ongoing confiscation of Palestinian land and existing discriminatory legal regime and today's forced displacement. In the words of Eitan Bronstein of the Israel Zochrot Remembering Association, if the Nakba never happened, it's impossible that millions of Palestinians today are refugees who demand restitution of their rights. But the reality is, there are millions of Palestinian refugees today. And in our first interview, we'll be speaking with a high school teenager who has spoken and who has worked directly with them. And now I'd like to welcome Shireen to our show. And welcome, Shireen. Good morning. And welcome, Shireen. Good morning. And welcome
to
This Week in Palestine. Thank you for being here. I'd like to start with a very simple question with you. How did you get involved in working with Palestinian refugees?
My mother is actually a refugee lawyer, so she was researching and teaching in Jerusalem in 99 and 2000. So I went to live there with her for a year, and I was in first grade, but it really, really affected my life. So every year after, I asked to go back, and then finally in 2009, my mom helped arrange it, so I lived with a family in a refugee camp, and I had a refugee camp in Bethlehem for a month and volunteered with that group in that camp.
That's great. And what is it that you saw in the daily life of Palestinian refugees that motivated you to get involved? Was there something specific that you witnessed?
Yeah, I think I was really inspired by their resilience and ability to smile after horrible events that occur every day, like imprisonment of family members without reason or shooting that occurred every night when I was in the camps. Mm-hmm. So they would always want to tell me their stories and just smile, and that that was the most inspiring thing.
So in a way, it was almost impossible not to get involved.
Yeah.
And in terms of what kind of work do you do with refugees in the times that you've spent in Ida camp, or I also know that you've spent some time in Lebanon as well.
Yeah.
If you can describe for us some of your experiences from both of those camps.
All right. In 2009, our biggest activity in Ida camp was bringing together refugees for a four-day camp for around 150 preteens and young teenagers. And it was the first time these kids got to meet refugees from other refugee camps in other cities. And I was a counselor, and I also got to translate for the internationals that were there.
Mm-hmm.
We had like guest lectures every day about BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, and refugee rights, right to return, and then international perspectives on the conflict, and then how the refugees can tell their own stories, because these kids have so many stories that they want to get out to the world.
And in what ways did you work with these preteens and these younger children in terms of getting their story out?
Well, we did a lot of workshops, like writing workshops for them to be able to share, and mainly, I guess, just talking to them, because they're really excited to meet anyone who's interested in them from mm-hmm. elsewhere. So we did interviews, and I translated, and that was really exciting.
And how would you characterize the response of refugees? You do mention that they were so excited that people wanted to listen to their story
yeah.
and hear about their plight. But in general, what kind of responses did you receive from all of those workshops and efforts in Ida camp?
Yeah, just positive, welcoming. They're so welcoming. And, yeah. But it was really different in my next experience in Lebanon.
Right. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that now. How different was it in Lebanon versus working in the West Bank?
Really completely different because, well, I did two activities in Lebanon. The first was a reconciliation camp. So the Lebanese government helped set that up. It was between, or it brought together youth from around Lebanon and Palestinian refugees living in Lebanon as well as from the West Bank and in refugee camps in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was the youngest one, but we had also lectures about political activism, mm-hmm. which is a little bit difficult for me to keep up with because it was on her. But we also met with like dignitaries and the prime minister and other big figures and talked about the importance of better relations between the Palestinians and Lebanese,
mm-hmm.
which I found really depressing because we lived for a week and a half with these refugees who were all, the refugees who were in the program with me, who many of them had almost nothing, and then we were going to these houses of extremely wealthy people, and I felt,
there was a huge dichotomy between those houses and
yeah.
the life of refugees.
Yeah.
Now, the houses that you visit, were these the houses of, like, the Lebanese or Lebanese-Palestinians?
Like, the prime minister and the head of the Maronite church.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was really eye-opening.
So it's extreme contrast there. And what refugee camps did you visit during your time in Lebanon?
I actually only got to go into Shatila because I tried three times to get into Ain al-Halwa, which is the biggest refugee camp in the south, but they don't allow U.S. passport holders, anyone who doesn't have a Lebanese or Palestinian paperwork to get in.
So there's a lot of like security restrictions in terms
yeah.
of even just applying to visit Palestinian refugees there.
Right, and the second camp I did was for a week with children who are all refugees from Ain al-Halwa and, Nahr Bared, Reshidiya refugee camp, and Shatila. And they were all together for a week, around 45 kids from 7 to 14. And that's where I saw the biggest difference between all the hope in the children in Palestine with the lack hope in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. And in what ways did these children that you worked with in Lebanon show that lack of hope? Was it that they were just not as excited as the young people in Palestine, or what was it about them that was so different?
I think they were excited to have foreigners there, but I'm not exactly sure that it might be in Palestine that they're in their land, something about that.
Mm-hmm.
But Lebanon, there's like a lack of connection. A lot of kids don't know what city their parents or grandparents were forced out from.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in the camps in Lebanon, there's a much lower education system. The Lebanese government doesn't really take care of the education system in the refugee camps. So most of the kids I was working with actually were dropping out of school by the time they reached sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
so which is around 11 years old, to work in their dad's shops or something like that. They felt like even if they completed their education, they wouldn't be able to get a job because,
right.
well, partly because of the poor school systems in the camps, but also because in Lebanon, it's not possible for a Palestinian to get equal job opportunities as a Lebanese. And that there's been a recent law that's like given them more opportunities, but still it's not anywhere near equal.
Not enough. So there's a huge struggle for civil rights for Palestinian
yeah.
refugees in Lebanon. And in terms of the activities that you engaged in, were they very similar with the Lebanese
Yeah, they were pretty similar, but the kids knew a lot less about. They were also, there was like less of a sense of community with them, and there was more fighting with them, and Yeah.
So it was more difficult to kind of get that effective participation and get people working with each other. Mm-hmm. If refugees were able to provide three key messages to our listeners today, what would those messages be? What do you think their messages would be that were conveyed in the time that you spent in Palestine and Lebanon?
I think the biggest message is that these refugees are the same kind of people as we are. And they always want Americans to know that they're human just like us. And especially the kids, they don't understand why they're thought of as terrorists or not human. And they want to be treated like that. And they want people to know about their struggle, and they want to get their voices out.
The key message. Do you have any parting thoughts for our audience today, Shireen? Anything else that you feel that Americans need to know about Palestinian refugees?
Well, I just thought that anyone my age can really get involved, and they should not feel limited to what they see every day and get out there, whether it's with any kind of people who are oppressed.
And have you encouraged, like, your classmates, the people that you go to school with, to get involved, as you did?
Yeah, I try to encourage people and take them to events around here, or tell them my stories, or the stories of the family members I lived with. Those are the most amazing.
That's great. I thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
I hope to talk to you again.
Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye. And now we'll be moving on to two of our other guests. And that will be Nidal and Amal. Amal is an anthropologist, documentarian, and volunteer with Laji Youth Center and Ida Refugee Camp. And Nidal himself is actually a refugee from Ida Camp in Bethlehem, the West Bank. And he's a volunteer at the Laji Center, a youth center in Ida Camp. And allow me a moment to bring them into the line. Yes, good morning, Amal, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. We're actually on the air together. And I'd like to begin by asking you also what motivated you to work with Palestinian refugees.
Well, I've been interested in the Palestinian issue for a very long time. My family are actually Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. When I began doing field work for my PhD in anthropology, I realized how important it was to spend time in a refugee camp and to learn about refugee issues because, you know, in the West Bank, refugees are not quite as different from the rest of society as they are, for example, in Lebanon, but it's still definitely a different part of society, and it's really important to understand what's going on in refugee camps and to sort of get a refugee's perspective on Palestinian politics and society.
Exactly. And what would you say is the refugee viewpoint? I know, I understand it can vary amongst refugees in different areas, for example, such as in Palestine or Jordan, Syria or Lebanon. But in general, what would constitute like a refugee viewpoint of what's going on in Palestine today?
Oh, well, of course, there are many. There are as many refugee viewpoints as there are refugees.
Exactly.
But, you know, I think people that I worked with and got to know, you know, are sensitive to questions of the right of return, for example, and are, you know, I think also have a keen awareness of social divisions within society, because refugee camps are kind of separated off from the rest of society, and living conditions tend to be a little bit poorer there. So, it's a really important perspective from which to look at the rest of Palestinian society.
Right, and unfortunately often ignored in negotiations and generally in making policy. What kind of work do you do with refugees, or have you done with refugees?
Well, with my husband, Nidal, who's also on the line here, I've worked with Leje Center. Nidal has worked with them a lot longer than I have, but it's a youth organization in Ida refugee camp established in 2000 that does a lot of different kinds of work with kids, you know, from sort of fun stuff like day trips and art classes and summer camps to more serious stuff like teaching children about their rights, about human rights, and, you know, providing sort of support for education and things like this.
And how have refugees responded to all these efforts? How have the kids in the refugee camps responded to the work that the Leje Center does?
I think they're really excited, grateful, creative, sort of embracing that work with all of their own creativity and intelligence and you know, bringing their own stuff to it, which is wonderful, wonderful to see every time we go.
Can you describe one of the activities that you personally have done at Leje Center?
I worked on a children's book with my husband, Nidal, called The Boy in the Wall, and we kind of collaboratively wrote a story about how kids were responding to the separation wall being built around Ida Camp, and then illustrated it together. So it was wonderful doing these collages with teenagers to sort of help them express sort of their hopes for having more freedom. Another thing I did was to take youth under the age of like 14 or so to Jerusalem, because once the kids are 16, or even if they look 16, they can't really go into Jerusalem because they'll have an ID that's a West Bank ID, and then they're not permitted to enter Jerusalem. But me, because I'm an American citizen, I can actually take kids into Jerusalem. So we did that, and we took a lot of pictures in Jerusalem. You know, we'd worked with the kids on some basic photography skills. So those were some really exciting days.
And how was the response of these teenagers to being in Jerusalem? I'm sure for some of them it was maybe the first time they've ever been there, and maybe in some cases the only time they would have the opportunity to go.
I think for many of them it was the first time. And these were kids from the ages of about, I would say, 8 or 9 to about 12 or 13. I mean, it was astonishing, you know, to be in Jerusalem's old city. Their parents and older brothers and sisters had sort of given them a little shopping list because, of course, they're not allowed to go to Jerusalem. So, you know, they wanted, you know, spices, or they wanted sweets, or so on and so forth. We went to the Dome of the Rock and to Al-Aqsa, and that was a real honor and privilege and very exciting. It was like one of the wonderful things about the Dome of the Rock, Al-Haram al-Sharif, is that there's like a lot of open space for the kids to sort of run around and be, and it just struck me that in this sort of place that, you know, is thought of as a holy site and sort of very sanctified, it's also just a lot of place for kids to run around, much more place than they have in the camp. And it was very suitable for them to be doing that. You know, we brought in our falafel sandwiches and had a picnic, and it was wonderful. I mean, they also visited the mosques themselves, but in the sort of open space, they just had a wonderful time, and that was great to be a part of that.
Exactly. I can almost see them running on the Haram al-Sharif right now. You've created a great visual image.
They were, like, sitting in the trees. I mean, it was wonderful. You know, these girls sitting in the trees. It was a great day.
And obviously gave them a sense of freedom that they often don't have in the camps.
Absolutely.
Like I asked Shireen previously, if refugees were able to provide three key messages to our listeners today, what would you think these messages would be? What do you think that they've tried to convey to us to change the situation in Palestine?
Well, I think, you know, many refugees are really interested in emphasizing the importance of the right of return. You know, more than 60 years after they and their families have been dispossessed of their lands, that they still have those rights and that they need to be insisted upon. So I think that's the very most important message.
I also find it amazing, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the introduction, that 70% of refugees worldwide today are Palestinians, and you would think after so many decades that there would be some addressing of their issues.
Yes, the largest population of refugees and internally displaced people, and the longest, you know, one of the longest displaced groups as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, most refugees have had the opportunity to return to their homes. You know, resettlement is not the most common resolution for refugees' problems. return is. And so return should be the way that this refugee crisis is also returned. As you might be able to hear, we have a little daughter here.
Exactly.
She's about 4 months old, and you know, she also has the right to return to her home.
That's true. I mean, the right of return is expected for, you know, was expected in Bosnia, was expected in several African nations, so why should the Palestinians be any different?
Exactly.
In concluding my part of your interview, do you have any parting thoughts or anything else that you'd like to say to our audience today?
Well, I thank you for doing this interview, and I also think, you know, to the extent that people can sort of learn more about refugees, either by visiting refugee camps or by checking out, I mean, I think lately there's been so much youth filmmaking, and Legit Center, again, has made these storybooks and some of these digital storytelling that recently played in the Boston Palestine Film Festival. And there's just so many different ways to learn about refugees and to do it kind of from their own perspectives, you know, from a lot of these media that youth have been involved in creating. So I hope people can take advantage of seeing those, even if they can't get to Palestine or to Lebanon or Jordan or Syria.
Great. And I thank you for pointing out that there's many ways that people can approach this, regardless of whether they can travel there, that if they're in media, they can approach it from a media perspective. If they're a teacher, they can look for opportunities to work with young Palestinian refugees. Thank you again, Amal, for being with us today.
Thank you.
And good morning, Nadal.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to have you on our show today.
No, thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And I'll start with the same question that I've asked our two other guests. How did you get involved in working with refugees? Of course, you yourself are a refugee, so in a sense, maybe it's inescapable because you were born and raised in the camp. But what motivated you to continue working with your people?
Well, where I was born and raised almost all my life in either refugee camp, there are lots of social and political activities going around. But the way how I got involved in my work with Lajee Center, I was badly injured in the invasion of 2002, where, you know, there was like tanks and around 500 soldiers with two Apache helicopters surrounding the Ida camp, and it was a heavy invasion, and I was badly injured in this invasion, so I couldn't work at that time. So Lajee Center, the volunteers at Lajee Center, they came to me and asked me to come and work with children and youth, and I have been working with them since then.
So your involvement was because of your experience and your need to overcome that experience and help other Palestinian refugees deal with that, and I'm sure that your experience is very common. What kind of work do you do with Palestinian refugees at the Lajee Center?
Oh, we do a lot of things. My work with the children and the teenagers for Ida camp at Lajee Center is focused on human rights and refugee rights issues and lectures. I work with almost 300 children under the age of 18. From the camp. Also, there are like work that focused on the education levels. Like, you know, the United Nations schools in the refugee camp are very crowded. There is no space, really, in the classroom for the students to be creative, to do like art and music things. So we provide them with this. We always we also have for example, summer camps and trips. And one of the important activities that Lajee organize is to take these children to visit their home villages that their parents and their grandparents were forced to leave in 1948 and 1967. So this is the type of work that I do with them.
And I know, in having visited Ida camp myself, that many of these villages are not very far, even from where the Palestinian refugees live today. So I'd like to ask you, how have the refugees responded to these field trips and to the different activities that you offer at Lajee Center?
Oh, they always appreciate it, and they always look for it. Not just the children and the teenagers, mm-hmm. also their families. You know, mm-hmm. they always come to the Lajj Center, ask about the activities, because basically Aida Camp is very crowded, very small. We're talking about around 5,000 refugees who live in this camp, and this camp is about a 2 city blocks of New York, let's say, and they're surrounded by suppression walls and Israeli military bases. And the only place that's left for children is the street, actually, mm-hmm. and the streets are really crowded with cars, with people, with work and constructions. So, because we provide them clean environment at Lajji, they really, really appreciate it a lot, and they really like it. I mean, they always look for the opportunity to come and participate in the activities and the trips. And I always feel like when I take a walk in the camp, the mothers and the fathers of the children that we work with, they always like, you know, ask me and talk to me and thank me and thank us at Lajji Center, and they always like encourage their children to go there.
So the Lajji Center really serves as a community space where they can express themselves, where they can be children, where they can participate in all of these activities, where they can learn about their rights. Now, as I asked Shireen and Amal, if refugees such as yourself and such as the people you've worked with in Aida Camp were able to provide 3 key messages to our listeners, what would those messages be? What do you think they would like to tell us?
I would start with the right to return. You know, without it, I don't think there will be any solutions, any, you know, peace in the area, because refugees, either in the Ikubat territories, in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, or in the Arab world, are living in a very hard environment. You know, there will not be any solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict without solving the refugee issues. Also, a message that I would like to send also, you know, we should have our freedom to move. You know, when we talk about the right to return, for example, when I ask my parents, where do you want to live? Do you want to go back to your villages? They will say, yes, of course, mm-hmm. I want to go back. I want to die there in the land. But for me, I'm a refugee and I love my village. I visit it. But I like to visit, to live in Haifa or Yaffa or Akka near the sea. So we should, as Palestinians, have the freedom also to live anywhere in Palestine, and also to be recognized as human beings who have rights to live with freedom and dignity.
That's excellent. You've made some three excellent points there. Do you have any additional parting thoughts for our audience? Anything else that you would like to tell us today about yourself or Palestinian refugees?
Yeah, I would like to say, like, you know, refugee camps, either in the West Bank, in Gaza, or in a place like Lebanon, are very, very crowded. There are like a huge generation who is growing up without future in these refugee camps. This generation, I'm talking about, you know, 18 to 23, 24 years old, who have no jobs. They live with their families. Their families are poor. They can't provide them, you know, buy a land and build them houses. They don't have any future. This generation will explode mm-hmm. soon, and without really, really working together, all of us to have or to think or to reach a solution for the refugee case, I think there will not, as I said in the beginning, there will not be any solutions. And also to take any opportunity to learn about refugees in Palestine and outside Palestine through media, through the internet, through radio shows like this. It's really, really rich ground for information, for different perspectives on Palestinian, on the whole conflict.
Yes,
and they're really, really a key elements in this struggle.
I thank you very much for joining us today, Nadal, and I thank both you and Amal for joining us today and shedding some light on the Palestinian issue.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And this concludes our show for This Week in Palestine for October 31st. And as you can see, there are many ways of getting involved with Palestinian refugees, as well as how important it is to influence American policy and highlight the right of return in any just and viable solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Despina Mutsuris, and this has been This Week in Palestine. Thank you.